members of the museum staff, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here. Two reasons. Number one, I feel that I am basically at home and I'm comfortable with most of the people that I see out here because they've had many of the same experiences that I've had. The other reason is because I think there are some rather unique things that I can convey to you as my impressions that you haven't been able to read in books. Two reasons. Number one, nobody thought about recording a lot of that stuff, and some of the things that were done, they didn't want to record it. I'm kind of a, I guess you might say, I've got kind of a perspective on this thing that not too many people have had, because of the fact that with the passing of General Curtis LeMay, I'm one of the last of the general officer group that were out there in that area to be able to come up here and stand up here on your own 2 feet and talk to you. What I want to do tonight, and I have to apologize because most of your speakers, I won't say most, but a lot of your speakers that would come here would have all kinds of pictures and all kinds of graphs and charts to put on there, but I don't have that kind. I'm going to try to draw a word picture, and I hope that I can convey the proper meaning. I've got a stopwatch here, and I just started it. I want to hold my remarks to roughly 45 minutes in order to give us some time to address questions. In that way, I feel that if I talk a little bit about the going into the war, a little bit about Europe, a little bit about the problems back here in the States with the B-29 and getting on the bomb project, what happened then, I can open Pandora's box and we can have a lot of fun with questions after that. With that, everybody relax and let me get started as far as the pre-war Air Corps is concerned. When I graduated from the flying school in February of 38, I was told that the Air Corps at that particular time had approximately 1,500 officers. Most all of them were pilots because non-rated officers were not welcome in those days. And I don't know, there was something like 30 to 40,000 people. Don't hold me to numbers because I don't remember them too well, but I guarantee you that there weren't too many. And we all belonged to the Army. We were, should we say, looked upon with grave suspicion by the Army. My first duty station was Fort Benning, Georgia. And I assure you that they wasted no time in letting me know I was wearing an Army uniform at that time with a pair of wings on them. But anyway, they let you know right away, you belong to the Army. And Army policy, Army tradition, everything prevails. The only thing that was different, we got a 50% increase in our base pay for flying, and they just couldn't understand why we should get extra money to fly an airplane. Well, if I look backwards now, I don't know. I probably paid them. I had so damn much fun. Anyway, that gave us an opportunity, gave me an opportunity to get into some of the, let me put it this way, some of the things that were going on, inter-service politics, I guess maybe is the way we'd talk about it today, and found that the Army was steeped in tradition. They had blinders on. Man, you couldn't, if it wasn't in an Army regulation, if it wasn't an Army's policy, forget it. You couldn't do it. It couldn't even be addressed if you want to get right down to the nitty-gritty on the thing. So what am I talking about? I can remember some of the senior officers in the Air Corps in those days wanting to get better radio equipment to go in an airplane. In other words, there were on the civilian market, there was radio equipment at that time that didn't weigh some 60 to 70 pounds and didn't occupy, God, I don't know how many feet, about 18 inches across and probably 10 inches deep and about 8 to 9 inches in height, because anything that was procured by the Signal Corps, it, as a radio transmitter, receiver, or whatever it might be, it had to be able to be operated in a truck and a tank. Well, obviously that put a lot of weight and put a lot of equipment in airplanes that were not the best that could be purchased at that time. But again, you think we got problems with money today, we had problems in those days, because the first maneuver that I ever went on the Fort Benning Reservation, playing the part of an aviator, doing support for the ground troops, like picking up messages, dropping messages, addressing artillery fire. I used to be able to sit in the back of an airplane, work the code key, and have the battery put the shells wherever they were supposed to put them, or at least close to them. And I learned a lot in those days, and it stuck with me over the years. Now, one of the things, I started on the problem of money. We did not have the equipment at Fort Benning, Georgia. Now, I use the term we because they told me I was in the Army. We did not have the equipment. We didn't have howitzers. We didn't have tanks. So what did we do? When you had a maneuver, you took a bed sheet, you tied it on the side of a truck, and you said, this is a certain type of a tank. Or you put some crates and things out in the field, and this is a howitzer. Those were the type of things. We had to make all kinds of things. Now, one of the things I do remember that was really great sport, they did accept the fact that an airplane might come flying down the road and strafe troops marching. Well, that was a serious thing. And it was a serious thing to the people running the maneuver. But you take Fort Benning, Georgia in July and August when a GI is out there and he's carrying a gun and a pack on his back, when he gets his respirator, he doesn't want to get himself out of the way or do anything. He wants to plop down in the nearest thing to that roadway where it's a little bit of shade. And we found that the first couple of days of our maneuver. Now, that didn't worry the ground troops because they've been so used to that all the time in their maneuvers, but it worried us guys that were flyboys because we got to thinking, well, damn it, if we fly over some troops like that with the idea of strafing them, they're not supposed to take their hats off and wave at us. They should be going for the ditches and getting in the woods. Now, we cured that. I didn't. I was a third interest in it. One of the older men down there, who happened to be a first lieutenant, his name was Bill Amherst. Wouldn't mean anything to you, but Bill was an old-timer. In those days, there were some lieutenants in the Army, Air Corps, there were some lieutenants in the Army that had 17 years of service in their first lieutenants. Promotion list didn't have vacancies to get them promoted. A captain was kind of a high-ranking guy. I'll tell you one thing, a colonel could walk on water. There was no question about it. Now, when this happened, being at Fort Benning, Georgia, we're in the area of sorghum and stuff like that, Bill Amherst and another fellow went out into the area, one of these presses where they get all of this stuff, and they got a drum, I don't remember how much it was, they got a drum of this sticky stuff, brought it back, and they mixed it with kerosene. And they put it in the spray tanks that we had. So next time we strafed some troops on the ground and they didn't run anywhere, they got mighty sticky. And, of course, we had to stop that after two attempts because that kind of disrupted the whole maneuver. They didn't have clothes. They couldn't take that sticky stuff off, and that disrupted everything and threw them out of schedule. Okay, now that's one of the types of things. What I'm saying is money was tight in those days. Airplanes were old, they were tired, and they were underpowered. I'll quickly say that we didn't have any airplane that I flew, including the end of the war, didn't have all the power it needed. I never saw enough power in an airplane until the jet engine came along. And that was the salvation of the whole thing. Now, I'd like to move along rather quickly and tell you my perception of what happened when the war was declared. We saw the buildup, and we saw the thing start in 39 over in Europe with the Germans going into Poland. It appeared, and many of the officers at Benning who were supposed to be strategists, tacticians, and so forth, they said, we're going to go to war. Well, being a 25-year-old, I accepted what they said, but the implication or the magnitude of that thing really didn't hit me until the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. When they bombed Pearl Harbor, I had been on maneuvers up in North Carolina. By that time, I was away from Fort Benning. I was flying the A-20s. And on the Friday before the bombing on Sunday, I'd gotten orders to go to MacDill, Tampa, Florida, and become a member of the 29th Bomb Group. The 29th Bomb Group was scheduled to get some B-17s. And I thought, gee, this is going to be great. I'll get close to a four-engine airplane. However, the rules at that time, if you were going to be a co-pilot in a B-17, you had to have 2,000 hours in the minimum of 3 year service. If you were going to be checked out and sit in the left seat, you had to have 10 years service and 5,000 hours. So that's the requirements on it. I hate to tell you this, but I just had a grandson graduate from Williams. He got 220 hours and he signed it a B-1. Well, as I told him, he'll never have the fun I had flying airplanes, because in those days, we had a CAA, not an FAA, and the CAA operated, their communication were through the different range stations that were located along the airways. They were mostly, they were obviously close to the major airports, but as you went down the different airways, I don't know, the greens and the reds and whatnot, kind of hard to remember them this time of day, but as you went down there, you went from one range station to another. You were supposed to be no more than 100 miles apart, and I think that was pretty close. And those men would talk to you, they'd tell you what the traffic was between where you were and where you were going, and they'd give you weather reports, and they kind of encouraged you, to keep your chin up, because if you had bad weather, it didn't make any difference. If you had to get there, you had to go right through it. And very often you'd get caught in weather that you weren't anticipating because the forecasting wasn't that great. We didn't have satellites. We just had guys on the ground at different locations taking certain suns and certain readings, and then they would draw a weather map. Now, this was about a 6 to 8 hour process, so you can appreciate that a lot of that weather was behind time. But it didn't make any difference. We did some things in those days that, as I look at it today, were rather foolish and foolhardy, because airplanes, if you get into a thunderstorm, the airplanes used to lose their wings, they used to lose their tail sections, all kinds of strange things happened to them. A lot of people got killed, but on the other hand, we had to wear a parachute every time we got in an airplane, and that was a lifesaver. Very appropriate thing to do, wear that parachute, because you never knew when you were going to need it. Now, when they bombed Pearl Harbor, the maneuver was finished. I was on my way back to Savannah, Georgia, riding along fat, dumb, and happy up there at about 3,000 feet, listening to the radio, because that radio had a Homer on it. It was directed me to Savannah, Georgia. When the announcement comes on that Pearl Harbor had been bombed, my first reaction was, gosh, there goes Orson Welles again. But the more I listened to it, the more I realized that they were serious. Now, with that seriousness, when I got back to Savannah, Georgia, I can assure you that pandemonium reigned supreme. This is something that nobody had prepared for, nobody had anticipated that we would suddenly, on a Sunday morning, find ourselves in a defensive position or about to get in one or two as far as the Japanese were concerned. When I got back, my concern was, where do I go from here? Now, by that time, I was an advanced promoted captain. That's what I was. I was a captain. And I got that with almost 4 years of service, whereas you weren't supposed to get it until you had 10. And so I went in and to my operations and, reported my presence. I said, okay, I got orders to join the 29th Bomb Group at Tad MacDill. What will I do? He said, sit still. 29th Bomb Group's coming to Savannah. I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, they're afraid the Japanese submarines are going to surface in Tampa Bay as Shell MacDill, so they're coming up here. Well, these are I'm not trying to be facetious. These people were deadly serious because something happened that they hadn't planned for. Does it sound familiar? How about the desert? Okay. Invariably, I spent 3 years in the National Military Command Center in the Joint Staffs in Washington, and I'll guarantee you we had a war plan for anything that could happen, any kind of a contingency plan you name. But one of the outstanding was when John F. Kennedy got assassinated, nobody had the first plan for that one. They didn't have a plan for the things that really took place. So this leads me to advance the theory or advance the situation proposition to, for you to think about. Are we really prepared for what we're doing today? Our senior commanders have not had the latitude of being individualists and expressing their, should we say, beliefs, personalities, and so forth, because everything has been run from the White House. And I truly and seriously concern myself. Witness what happened when they tried to go into Tehran and get the hostages out of there. General Carter might have been one of the greatest guys in the Navy, but on the other hand, he wasn't a man who was qualified to run that operation, but he did. He told them every move to make. I listened, well, I had that position in Washington, I listened to Lyndon Johnson tell corporals in Vietnam what to do. Now that's something else when the President of the United States is telling a corporal what to do out when he's out in the trenches. But I heard it, and that sort of thing. So these are things that I'm worried about. I'm worried about all these sophisticated communications that we've got. I'm worried about the lack of being able to maintain a certain discreet, should we say, secrecy regarding intentions. And the worst thing you can do is to advise the enemy of your intentions, but as soon as that happens, as soon as somebody comes up with an idea, you read about it in the paper. And I don't think these things are good. But let's get back to FONA. When it got to the point that I got into B-17s and I'm ready to go to war, well, I was ready as everybody could be because I had a B-17 and I had a crew to fly with me. But that crew that had to fly with me were people that had been pulled out of training anywhere from 3 months to 3 weeks. Ahead of their completion of their courses, they were half trained, as I would say. By the same token, they weren't trained to do what we found out we had to do. For instance, when we got to Europe, and there's an awful lot of things that took place getting there, but when we got to Europe, there were two bad things that confronted us. It confronted me, anyway, because I was interested. I was a squadron commander at this time. I had a squadron of 12 B-17s and crews. Not one man in there had ever fired a machine gun. Not one man in there could strip a machine gun. Well, I became the worst bad name that you can imagine when I told my crews that they were going to go out and sit down with a blanket on the ground. They were going to take their machine gun out and they're going to have classes. Before they got through, they were going to be able to strip that machine gun and reassemble it blindfolded. Now, that may sound a little bit far-fetched, but on the other hand, stop and think about it. They're flying up in the air. Their life depends upon them. That thing jams. They can't see what they're doing. They have to do everything by feel. And one of the worst things that I possibly could have told them to do was, I said, those guns have come from a factory. They have full of cosmoline, and what you're going to do is you're going to take boiling water, you're going to take soap, and you're going to wash all that cosmoline off of them. Well, nobody ever heard of putting a gun in water. You always kept it very well oiled. Well, they did what I told them to do, but then they turned right around and they took machine oil and put on all of those parts. So the first mission that we flew, I only had one gun out of 11 operating. They froze up. I didn't have to say another word. So the next mission we went on, I'll tell you, every gun functioned perfectly. And that's the way it worked. Now, those people that were not, should we say, properly prepared, we lucked out. We got by in our first few flights while we all learned. We had time enough to do that. We learned, but we learned the hard way. And when somebody's shooting at you seriously, you learn fast, I can assure you. All right. Our command, when we got to England, it had not been decided. It had not been, should we say, established between Roosevelt and Churchill whether or not the American forces would operate as an independent force or a cohesive force, or whether they would fill the RAF as fillers, in other words, for vacancies, assist the RAF. I got in on that to some degree, not as a participant, but as a guy standing on the side, because I had to fly my bosses down there to the Bomber Command headquarters where some of these discussions took place. And I got to sit around in the side of the room in a chair as long as it didn't say anything. and I heard all of this discussion, and I assure you it was a very serious thing. We did not know for about 30 days after we started operating whether we were going to operate as independents or whether we were going to be under the British command. Well, there's a difference in philosophy. You know, the British area bombed everything at night because they couldn't exist in the daytime. Our people were convinced that properly flown, properly escorted with fighters, and properly equipped with good gunners and multiple numbers of airplanes, we could survive. The argument was finally settled in that it was decided that the Americans would be an independent operating force. Now, we had another side issue there. I don't know how many of you read books, but if you have read them on the 8th Air Force and so on, you'll find out that a lot of commanders started out with organizations, but they didn't last very long. They might have lasted a month or 6 weeks, and they were replaced. Unfortunately, the commander of my organization, of 97th Bombardment Group, was one of these men who was an old-timer. He was, and I say an old-timer very cautiously, because he, in those days, he wasn't as old as I am now. But he didn't know what to do. He just didn't know what his responsibilities were. Now, that makes things kind of rough. You've all heard about Frank Armstrong. You've all either seen the movie or read the book 12 O'Clock High. Frank Armstrong was sent in to replace this man because what he did was just to, I guess, forget everything, he jumped into the bottle. He started drinking very heavily, and he did nothing. I was let alone because, for what reason, I don't know, but I had learned a little bit from my father, who had been a company commander in World War I, who told me, number one, he said, you've got to remember that you're going to be responsible for your troops, for your men under you. He said, they look to you for leadership. And he said, you owe them that much. Think of them first. Don't worry about yourself. They'll take care of you if you take care of them. Well, I abided by that axiom, and I did. I stayed with my people all of the time, and I didn't go off and do things that other people were doing at that particular time, which was being entertained at the Rothschild estate with afternoon teas and Sunday grouse hunts. I stayed with my troops. I'd rather go on hunting. I don't care much about tea, but I like to hunt. Now, I'd rather have done that, but I knew that was not the proper thing to do. Armstrong came in to take command. Our boss was relieved. And Armstrong came in on a Sunday. Man at the gate was standing there, I'm told, I don't know. But anyway, I guess the movie portrays it pretty close to being correct. I mean, he just looked at Frank Armstrong, who at that time was a full colonel, and he didn't even say good morning, good afternoon, or anything. He just waved his hand for him to go on through. So Frank let the car go through, and then he got out, and he had a talk with that young man. And question is, you know, wartime and so forth, why do you wave somebody through to a bomber base like that until you know who they are? Well, that started it. He then came in and found the officer of the day, and he wanted to know where everybody was. And his officer of the day said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, is there anybody here? And I guess this guy said, well, Tibbetts is down at his quarters, down in the 340th Bomb Squadron area, so we'll go get him. So I came up and saluted, and he looked at me, and he said, what the hell are you doing here? I said, Colonel, I'm here because my troops are here. I think I belong with them. He said, that's right. And he said, I want you to get somebody to go over to the Rothschild estate and get everybody back here quick. Which we did. He had a meeting that same evening. He had a meeting and he laid the law down. He put the thing out. He said, look, this is a combat organization. It's going to be run like one. I'm going to tell you what to do. And you're going to do it. And he said, not only am I going to tell you, but I'm going to show you because I'm going to lead you. Well, okay, make a long story short. What we're talking about is leadership. Too many of the officers, after they got going into this thing and the more groups got over there, too many of the officers who were commanders of bombardment groups got too close to their men. In other words, if the group went out and screwed up, these officers would sympathize with them and say, well, it's really not your fault, and so on and so forth. This is where Frank Armstrong shone. He didn't stay with the 97th very long. because he did a good job there. And the next thing was that there were some more outfits that were not in too good a shape. And he was put in to run those. Now, when he got to them, he saw the fact that they knew what to do because they'd been around long enough to know what they should do. So he said, fellas, you're going to do it. Don't sit there and feel sorry for yourself. You're going to do it, and I'm going to stand back here and watch you do it. And believe it or not, he turned that organization around. So it's a different situation of leadership style and a different situation of personalities as such. Armstrong knew what should be done, and he got other people either to do it or to watch him when he did it. And I think that was great. Now, okay, we got to fight in the war, and the war went along fine. We come to the business of going to North Africa. North Africa is another one of these things where we were not prepared. We took I took six airplanes and took the Eisenhower staff from England down to Gibraltar, then took Mark Clark on into Algiers. We had no supplies of any kind. We'd been ordered to leave all of our clothing, bedrolls, and everything that we possessed. We had to leave them in England because we had to have room enough in the Bombays and the capacity of the airplane to carry the staff, their equipment, their maps, their everything that they needed to fight the war. When we got down there and things got to the point that we could, look or kind of stick our heads up without getting shot or having bombs dropped on us by the Germans, the situation is, well, what do? I've got six airplanes sitting down there wondering what to do with them. And I thought, well, we ought to be doing something to help this war effort. So I went and I'd gotten acquainted with General Mark Clark because I had flown him down to Gibraltar when he went to negotiate with Marshal Pétain to get his Pétain's agreement that he wouldn't have his troops oppose a landing in North Africa. It worked out real well. So I went to General Clark's headquarters and saw his executive officer, and the executive officer said, well, let's see what we can do about it. He took me to see Air Marshal Welch, a Britisher. Air Marshal Welch, very kindly a gentleman, and when I walked in and saluted him, he said, well, what can I do for you? And I said, Air Marshal, I said, I've got six B-17s sitting out here. I've got crews to fly them. I don't have any gasoline for them. I don't have any bombs for them. But if I had both, I could probably do something to help this war effort. So he said, well, he said, we could take care of that. We already knew through the grapevine that the British had brought in a supply ship down there that had fuel and they had bombs. Well, British bombs, of course, were hung by a single lug suspension, where ours had dual suspension. We carried with us part of our unit equipment on the airplane. We had to carry British bomb shackles so that we could carry British bombs if necessary. Make a long story short, he directed that we get to be given as he called it, a lorry, a truck, so we could go with the boat. And the boat was instructed to give us fuel, to give us bombs and everything we needed. Well, fine. It took me 1 day and a half to get ready. When I got ready, I went back to see the Air Marshal, and I said, sir, we're ready to go bomb somebody. He said, that's good. And he said, why don't you go bomb Deserta? I never heard the name. I said, where's Deserta? He said, oh, somewhere up there on the north coast, up in Tunisia. And I said, have you got a map? I was looking, for air charts and so forth like we had at our headquarters. He called his aide in and he said, can you get a map that shows where Deserta is? Very proper flight officer saluted and said, yes, sir. He'd gone about 15 minutes and he came back and he laid a map on the Air Marshal's desk, and the Air Marshal said, let's look. And he opened it up, and I walked over, and he pointed. He said, there's Deserta up there. He was pointing. It was a Standard Oil road map. Well, we used it, and I said to him, Air Marshal, okay, what time do you want me to strike the target? He said, well, whenever you can. I'd come from, even though the 8th Air Force wasn't the best organized in the world, they told us when to take off. That's just great. And so I understood from what he said then that I was on my own. And I'll tell you, nothing I like better than that. So Why did I like it? Because I thought that I knew better than anybody else down there what to do, because none of them had ever flown a B-17, let alone drop bombs on a target. So I got my guys together, 6 airplanes. I briefed them. I said, now we're going to go to Deserta. We're going to drop bombs. And this was in the late afternoon. I said, we're going to take off tomorrow morning. And I said, what we want to do is we want to come into Deserta. We want to get there about noontime. If we get there about noontime, it's not, you know, too far-fetched to believe that maybe they'll be going to lunch or something and we won't run into too much opposition. Now, that opposition we knew from the British intelligence sources with the fighter outfit. We knew that they had anti-aircraft guns and machine guns on the dock. The dock ran basically north and south, and the only way you really could approach it with any degree of security coming in was they had some 3,000 to 4,000 foot hills back of the docks by about, I don't know, I'm just guessing now, but about 5 or 6 miles back. But between the hills and the dock area, there was a German fighter squadron sitting there. Well, I told the fellas, I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to come in. We're going to take cover box. See, my A-20 days came in real handy to me. And I said, we're going to stay down below the level of those hills back there. We're going to slip up over the top of them. We're going to nose down and pick up some speed. We're going to go across that place at about 1,500 feet. I said, number one, they won't be able to traverse their guns fast enough to worry about it. Number two, we'll really get the element of surprise going in. Now, to end the story on that particular thing and that independent operation, that's exactly what we did. We came up. We had gone in. I had taken 3 airplanes in the lead. We flew right over the airdrome. The other guys were behind me. They dropped their bombs, 3 B-17 bomb loads, 500-pound bombs, and if I'm not mistaken, I think that put 30 bombs on the target. Dispersed, of course, because they were flying in the B formation. We went along, and we straggled our bombs, and as we went down the line, we did some damage. I can't tell you what the assessment was, because there was no way to get an assessment at that particular time. But I learned years later when I was assigned to NATO, because while I was there in the plan section, we got the first German officer assigned there. And he came in, he knew my name, and he knew my birthday, he knew everything about me. And I said, oh? He said, sure. He said, I was in intelligence. He said, we followed you guys beginning over in England. We know all about you, knew all about you. I said, okay, now you know so much. What did we do that day? He said, well, he said, you just wiped out one of Hermann Göring's squadrons because, he said, you not only damaged the airplane, but you got a direct hit on the officer's mess while they were eating. Okay, flying luck. Flying luck, but if you did it. What I'm really getting at is that if I had been ordered by headquarters to do that, if I'd been ordered by the 8th Air Force, they'd have had me fly up there at a minimum of 25,000 feet. The Germans would have known for 40 minutes before we got there, and they would have been up there with all of that fighter squadron to give us a rough time. And we didn't have that kind of defense, because the British were too busy taking care of themselves, even though there was a fighter wing on Maison Blanche where we were operating from. All right. We went back to Deserta 3 times, and as luck would have it, we made out in pretty good shape. Now then, the Germans got smart. And they started packing that place with a lot of guns that would traverse fast, and they got the different altitudes covered by using the equivalent of 40 millimeters instead of using 50 calibers and 88 millimeters. But they got that. Now, when we got further into the thing, we were down in the desert, and where I wanted to use some B-17s, and I couldn't operate on my own, but it was when Rommel got boxed in at the Kasserine Pass down there by Montgomery, Field Marshal Montgomery. I asked that the 12th Bomber Command, which was under the 12th Air Force, they were in Constantine and we were in Biskra. I asked them to let me go down there with the B-17s and anti-personnel bombs and get them, because they were all concentrated. They were all sitting there, just a beautiful target. They had some guns to defend with, but they didn't have any aircraft or anything to defend them. But no, you can't do that, because that's not our strategy. That's against policy. We have to, we have to carry at least 500-pound bombs on up, and we have to fly at high altitude. Well, I was told a little bit later that, you know, if that had taken place, there might have been less problem out of Rommel than they had a little bit later, but that's a different story. I'm telling you that we did not know. We didn't have a bombing plan. We didn't know anything until almost 1944 as to what strategic bombing meant. We bombed railroad marshaling yards, we bombed airports, we did all those things, which should have been done by some other outfit. In other words, medium bombers or fighters, attack airplanes, should have done a lot of those things. But we were thought we were the long-range arm, but we didn't go after the right thing. That's why when they finally decided what is the most important thing to the German, they settled on the ball bearing, and that's Regensburg and Schweinfurt. And they were bloody battles. In case you haven't read them, I'll tell you, they were bloody battles. Because the Germans did everything they could to defend them, but we did wipe out their ball bearings, and that began to bring their big army to a slow halt because they didn't have ball bearings to roll on. The machinery couldn't move as well as it had. Now, quickly, I've been critical, as I say. I'm not trying to fault anybody. I say to everybody, it was a case of the blind leading the blind. I got put into a position where I had the opportunity to learn things quick, what can work, what won't work. Two reasons. Number one, because I participated in it. And number two, because I knew the limitations of the equipment. I knew the limitations of the people, my own limitations included. So, okay, you take the advantage of everything you can take advantage of. And what I use an expression that I heard in business over in Columbus, that if you have a disability, take advantage of it. Well, I did this without understanding what I was doing when I went into to Biskra below 3,000 feet. I was taking advantage of a disability. We couldn't hit the target any other way. We didn't have the ability to bomb. The equipment wouldn't do it, so forth and so on. So, okay, we lucked out. Now, quickly, I came back to the United States. I was ordered back to the United States because I have to tell you this because of my... I don't know what you want to say, what word exactly to use, but my efficiency report written by superior said that I was very outspoken and that I had a tendency to step on senior officers' toes and so forth. Well, the man, my greatest friend, was John P. McConnell, when he was chief of staff of the Air Force. I was being talked about in a meeting of general officers. McConnell got up and said, damn it, he said, the only bastard that can get his toe stepped on is the one standing still. Well, I got a compliment on it, left-handed though it may be, but anyway, that was the point. I had responsibilities that I wanted to fulfill. I had responsibilities to this country. I had responsibilities to the men that worked for me. I had to do everything that I could to protect them as well as I could. I had to do everything that could be done with the resources I had available to do what a bomber airplane or a bomber crew and a squadron commander and a group commander should do. I got ordered back from Algiers because I got crossways with a man down there, and General Doolittle called me in one day right after it happened, and he said, Paul, I got to know General Doolittle while I was still down in the desert there, and he called me by my first name, which I always felt proud of. He said, Paul, I'm going to send you back to the States. How quick can you get ready? And I said, well, how quick do you want me to? He said, can you get your things together in 30 minutes? I said, yes, sir. He said, good. He said, two things. He said, I got a message from General Arnold. He wants my most experienced field grade officer in bomber airplanes to come back and get on an airplane known as B-29. The next thing, if I don't do that, I'm going to have to keep you here. The man that you insulted is going to file charges against you with a court-martial for insubordination. Then he told me something else. This is politics. He said, I'm sitting here with two stars on my shoulder. But he said, I don't really run this Air Force. And I thought, my God, you know, what is he talking about? And I guess I looked at him with amazed look. He said, my chief of staff's name is Hoyt Vandenberg. His uncle, Senator Vandenberg, controls the purse strings. Well, okay. He had more power than Doolittle had. And that that's true. Now, I came back to the United States. I arrived in Florida, having come out through Africa and up through South Africa and up through the islands in South America. And I found out right quick that Eddie Allen, Boeing's chief test pilot on B-29, had gotten killed in a crash of B-29 in the meatpacking plant out in Seattle. I'm doing pretty good. And the point there was that the B-29 had so many defects in it. And if you don't know, if you haven't read, you can find it in print on the history of the B-29. It was the first airplane up to that point that had ever put into production without the first thing being tested on it. We had multiple problems, I assure you. The engines were underpowered. They were weak. You couldn't cool the cylinders. When you got too hot of cylinders, your valve snapped off. They dropped down into the jug. The jug beat them all up. You had fuel lines in there. Fuel caught on fire. You had a magnesium case on the engine, and magnesium burns real well. And that's one of the things that we had. The rest of it was all different types of things with the airplane. The Bombay doors were no good. We had brake problems, multiple problems, electrical problems out the yin-yang, I guess is the best expression. This was the first airplane that, I don't know whether it's true or not, but somebody said there was about 120 miles of wire in a B-29 airplane. I can believe it. There was a lot of wire there. And so anyway, electrical problems were flamboyant. The fire control system was a remotely controlled system. It had headaches that you just can't possibly imagine. Malfunction of guns and the computer system that ran it. You could shoot the propellers off your outboard engine without any problem. those types of things were just commonplace. Now, Boeing had said, we're not going to build that airplane, it's no good. Roosevelt had promised that airplane to Chiang Kai-shek, and they told him it would be out in his theater in late 43, early 44. Well, I'm talking 43 right now, and they haven't come rolling out of the factory yet. I was ordered to go to join K.B. Wolf from Wright Field. K.B. Wolf was a very good production man on aircraft and so on and so forth. There was a whole team of people from Wright Field that was taken out there. I was the only misfit because I didn't belong to Wright Field, but I had been ordered to go there and get on that airplane by headquarters USAF, Hap Arnold by name. I did. So K.B. Wolf looked at me and he said, what can you do? I said, I can fly. He said, okay. He said, there's three of those airplanes sitting out there on the ramp right now, nobody to fly them. Go fly. Well, fine. I wasn't, dismayed by that. That didn't stop me, so I got out and I started talking to some of the Boeing factory guys. I said, who's ever been on this airplane? Well, they turned up with one man that had ridden with Eddie Allen a couple of times as an assistant flight engineer. So I got a hold of this man. I said, come on, we're going to go fly that airplane. I got a hold of a co-pilot who had never been any closer to the B-29 I had. So we got out there, we got in the airplane, had this guy brief us. I'd ask him when he got in it, I said, you know how to start the engines? I said, yeah, I know how to start the engines. I said, okay, fine. Let's go through it. You start the engines. And when you start the engines and tell me, well, we can taxi, he said, I'm going to taxi. We'll find out. So I did that. I got out on the runway and I taxied it up and down. Of course, he kept hollering at me and he kept saying the engines are getting hot and so on and so forth. Well, I wasn't used to anything like that because old B-17 engines and whatnot had run pretty cool. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, head temperatures are over 360 degrees right now. Mm. Well, that was really a dangerous situation because anything could happen. So we stopped and we let everything cool down, but I had gotten a little bit of a feel for the airplane. And I had this guy Sullivan, a man by the name of Sullivan, with me. And I said, Sully, I said, when we get these engines cool enough, I said, we're pointed down the runway. I said, I'm going to put the throttles forward on that thing. We're going to take off. It's okay. And that's exactly what we did. We flew by the book, so to speak. In other words, we had read a couple of pages in the book. It said that, if you get a certain airspeed, a certain weight, when you pull back on a wheel, it'll go up, and then you bring the gear up and the flaps and so forth and so on. Well, again, we lucked out, but I started flying that airplane at that particular time so Boeing could get more information off of it, and I wound up flying the airplane for about 10 months, a little over 10 months, and I learned a whole lot in that length of time on that particular airplane. Now, one day, I'm really having a very interesting deal. I've been assigned, as you read in that little resume there, that I got assigned to General Frank Armstrong's outfit out in Grand Island, Nebraska. Now, Frank had called me, and he said, look, I've been assigned to start a B-29 instructor school out there. He said, I want you to come and be my operations officer. Yes, sir. I'd be happy to get back with that man. So I did. I went out there, and first thing that happened to me, I didn't get to do anything about B-29 instructors because 2nd Air Force ordered me to go down to Gordon, work with a man by the name of Dr. E.J. Workman from the University of New Mexico. He was testing the B-29 against all the fighters that they could get their hands on. They had Jap Zero, they had the British Spitfires, they had all of ours, and so on and so forth. He had an instrumented setup, and he had 2 B-29s down there, fully equipped, ready to go. They had cameras on all the gun turrets, cameras on the fighter, but they couldn't keep the B-29s flying. And Workman wanted to be down there, so maybe we could keep those airplanes flying. Well, I couldn't make the airplanes fly any more than they wanted to, because what he wanted to do was to get them up 25,000 feet and run them against the fighters and whatnot. We had a situation develop one morning. I went down, and the airplane that was supposed to make the mission had just lost a jug, one cylinder, couldn't take it off. The other airplane was having 2 engines changed on it. So Workman said, oh my God, money and time was involved. He said, we're ready for this test and so on and so forth. He said, what can we do about a B-29? I had flown down there in an old stripped out jug that had no guns on it, no nothing. It was just a flying machine. I had flown down there in that with 2 or 3 of my men to see if we could help Workman. I said, well, I don't know, but I can take this whole job out here. And I said, I can fly. He said, well, that's good. That's good. He said, you haven't got any turrets or anything on us. You can't instrument it. But we've got enough on the fighters that we'll do it. We take off, climb up, and initially leveled out at 25,000 feet, and the fighters came in and started making passes, and I'm watching just as interestedly as anybody could possibly be in what these fighters are doing. They're coming in, make their passes. The next thing I hear on the radio, tell him to slow down. Well, he is mean. And I thought, well, why? I looked at my altimeter. I'm sitting, at that particular time, I'm sitting at 30,000 feet. I've got an indicated airspeed at that point with this stripped-down airplane. I had an indicated airspeed of about 240 miles per hour. Well, that was almost unheard of. Fighters couldn't do that at that, and did better than that at that altitude. What was taking place was they were climbing up and getting a little bit above me. They'd make a pass at me with their gun cameras, but they couldn't recover and come back and catch me to make a second pass. Oh, I recorded that. I don't know what I was going to do with it at that time, but I thought, oh boy, I remember something. And sure enough, so rather rapidly, let's move on to my introduction to the Manhattan Project. I'm having a good time at Alamogordo when the phone rings down there, and General Ant, Commanding General of 2nd Air Force's executive, is on the phone. He said, General Ant wants you in his office tomorrow morning. Let's say 9 o'clock. I don't know if it was 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock. He said, want to see you in the morning? He said, to tell you to bring your B-4 bag. That's my clothing and everything. He said, tell you to bring your B-4 bag because you're not going back to Alamogordo. Yes, sir. Well, that doesn't too strange in a wartime. I mean, things like that. You get a strange order, you don't think anything about it. You don't question them. You just comply. I got to the headquarters. I walked in. Told the secretary who I was. She said, well, we've been expecting you just a minute. She punched a buzzer and told General Ent that I was out there. And apparently he said, just a minute. She said, wait. And out comes a lieutenant colonel wearing the insignia of the Corps of Engineers. He stuck out his hand. He said, I'm Jack Landale. He said, I want to talk to you. Well, immediately my thought process, well, why does a lieutenant colonel from the Corps of Engineers come out at Ent's office and he wants to talk to me? Fine. He said, let's step over here. There was a cloakroom. You know, they have cold weather in Colorado Springs. And this wasn't cold weather time, but the cloakroom was there, a small anteroom. He said, let's step over here. Let me ask some questions. So we stepped over into this room. He asked me 2 or 3. He had some papers in hand. He asked me 2 or 3 questions. Fine. I answered him. He said, have you ever been arrested? I said, yes. I said, my father was good to me. He bought me a Chevrolet Roadster when I was just old enough to drive it. I said, I had a heavy foot. I said, I got arrested for speeding several times. Does that mean that? Anything more serious? Well, something clicked. And I said, this guy knows more than he's letting on. He's trying to test me to find out. I said, yes. He said, what? I said, well, one time down at the place called Surfside on North Miami Beach, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I was in the back seat of an automobile with a young lady, and a chief of police comes up, shines a flashlight inside, and said, what are you doing? He laughed like you couldn't imagine. He said, okay, I'm happy. That's enough. Okay, he was finding out, would I tell him the truth if the going got rough? Well, I told him the truth, because I knew that's exactly what he was after. He walked back in and said, let's go see General Ed. We walked back in the office, and he turned to General Ed. He said, I'm perfectly satisfied. Lansdale was the head of the security for the Manhattan District. Okay, I got briefed because there were 2 other people there, one wearing a Navy uniform, Captain Parsons, who later flew with me on the Hiroshima mission. He was a naval gun expert. He'd been into that business of trying to build a bomb for a long time. The other man there was Dr. Norman Ramsey from Columbia University, a nuclear physicist. And Norman Ramsey, it turned out, was the man who I called my interpreter. He could talk to the nuclear scientists, and then he could turn around and talk to me in language I could understand. And that's how I got helped and got through this business of dealing with Dr. Robert Oppenheim and his crew. Now, that brings another thing to light. In the instructions that I got from General Ed after I learned this, General Ed said, look it. He said, you were selected as one of 3 people. General Arnold had 3 names. He told me to pick the man to do the job. And General Ed said, I picked you. The other man was a brigadier general and the other one a full colonel. I was a lieutenant colonel at this time. Well, I didn't say anything. And he said, I think you're the best qualified to do it. He said, now, you're going to put together this outfit. You're going to organize it. You're going to train it to be able to drop these weapons. He said, the only thing that I could do, the only thing anybody else could do, is to render you the normal assistance that would be expected of any group commander or any commander assigned to this Air Force. He said, I can't do anything special for you. You have to do that yourself. If you run into trouble that you cannot handle through the normal chain of command, you have a code word called Silver Plate. That code word is the one thing that will get you what you want. General Harnberg has said that he told his staff in Washington that code word will be honored regardless, without questions. Uh-huh. All right. Getting on to this thing, the outfit had some old B-29s that were really no good, and I wanted some new ones. I wanted the latest version of B-29 that I could get out of the factory. We had time enough to get them. I put in a requisition for 18 airplanes. The requisition came back to me disapproved. Well, in case of a disapproval, there was an officer in Washington that knew what was going on. He was assigned to the General Arnold's office, and he was the man that I was to call on the telephone and tell him I had a problem. And I did. I called him, and I said, his name was Wilson, R.C. Wilson, commonly called Bim. I said, Bim, I got a problem. He said, what's that? I said, I put in a requisition for 5 C-54s to accompany these B-29s, and it's been refused. Well, what do you want them for? I said, look, I'm supposed to be operating independently. I have to have those because we have to carry things that the Manhattan District doesn't want the Air Transport Command to know anything about. No questions, no bill of ladings, no nothing. He said, okay, I understand that. He said, send a requisition back in marked Silver Plate. I said, all right. I sent it back in marked Silver Plate. It came back in about 3 or 4 days. It came back disapproved. I called him and I said, it's disapproved. He said, well, he said, you got any business in Washington? I said, I've always got business in Washington, either in the Pentagon or with General Leslie Groves. And he said, okay, come on in here, bring the requisition to me and let me handle it. I said, fine. And I did just that when I handed in the requisition. Of course, you know, flying from Wendover to Washington, D.C. wasn't easy in those days, but we got there. He said to me, you got something else to do. And I said, oh, yes, I've got several things to do. He said, well, check with me now before you go. I said, all right. So I don't know, his whole day was gone, and I called him up, and I said, I'm just getting ready to get in my airplane and go back to Wendover. He said, you got a pencil? I said, yeah. He said, here are the serial numbers of your airplanes, and here's the dates of delivery. Good. I said, what happened? He said, very simple. He said, General Arnold, this morning when he had his staff meeting, he wanted to have the vice chiefs of staff come in, and he asked for the aircraft allocations officer from operations to come in with the vice chief for operations. His policy was to meet everybody at the door, say, good morning, General so-and-so, and so on. Officer in under discussion, he was a brigadier general, and he was temporary like everybody else was, but he was wearing one star, and he was the last one to come in according to the instructions that General Arnold had given his aide. As he walked through the door, he stuck his hand out, he said, good morning, Major. Without any hesitation, he broke him from a VG to a Major. He turned around, and the staff were standing there with their mouths open. He said, gentlemen, I mentioned one time that silver plate requisition would be honored without question. He said, do I need to say it again? I don't think he did. Now, I must tell you, I must confess, that I did take advantage of that particular ability of that requisition, because when I went out to the islands to brief General LeMay what was going on, I saw these GIs out there, and man, they were just trying to get their clothes clean. They used 50-gallon drums, they made wooden windmills to work the paddles up and down so that the clothes would get threshed around in there and get washed. I said, my guys deserve better than that. I'm not going to put up with that. When I got back, I put in a requisition to the, there was a civilian board that approved everything. I sent this requisition to the civilian board that I wanted 12 motor-driven Maytag washing machines. I got them. We took 12 motor-driven washing machines out there. Of course, the rest of the group out there, the fellas been out there fighting a hard war. They were rather envious, but we let them wash their clothes a little bit, too. Now, one other thing, and then I'm going to get really off of this subject because I want to open up the discussion. I'm not going to talk about the flight. You may have read enough about it. You may want to ask some questions relative to some specifics of it. But I would tell you this. It was the strangest command arrangement that you could possibly imagine in your mind. Here I am. By this time, I've been promoted to full colonel. I go out to brief General Curtis LeMay on what's going to happen in his area of interest. And I will say this, that the man didn't bat an eye. The only question that he asked me, he said, do you think the damn thing will work? I said, yes, sir, I do. He said, all right. Butch Blanchard was his director of operations. He said, if you want anything, you call Butch. I will tell Butch to give you what you want. When you get ready to go, you tell Butch what kind of an operations order you want. Yes, sir. He said, that's all he'll know. Well, okay, fine. And I think that's the way it really worked. So the situation was that LeMay said to me, he said, don't you think maybe it'd be a good idea to go over and talk to Admiral Nimitz? He's the theater commander out here. I said, yes, sir. I certainly do. Now, I hadn't been told to go brief Admiral Nimitz, but anyway, it seemed to me the only logical thing here, he is the equivalent of five stars at that time. And General May called on the telephone, got a hold of somebody in his office, and he said, go right on over. Go to Nimitz headquarters. He's waiting on you. I went over, met this gentleman. Only time I'd ever seen him, had been near him, found him to be a very quiet type of a person. He listened very carefully. His chief of staff, an admiral, vice admiral by the name of Kincaid, was there. And when I got through talking to him, he said, is there anything you need from us out here? I said, no, sir, I don't think of anything. Now, I didn't come ask you for anything. It's just to acquaint you with what my outfit is. He said, I appreciate that. He said, now, if you want anything that's within this naval command out here, you call Kincaid and he'll give it to you. Yes, sir. Well, Kincaid was standing there. I never had to do that. But that's the way that some of this stuff took place. So here's a full colonel, and I'm in a wing that belongs to Brigadier General at Canton. can't understand what's going on, because he wasn't even allowed to look at one of my airplanes when he when they landed there. He went out to look at them, and there's short of the story is that the guard, we had a guard on each airplane, and he wanted to go look at it. The guard said, halt, and he said, show out his ID card. He said, I'm General Davies. He said, I command this wing. That airplane's in my wing. I want to look at it. The guard said, General, do you have a, I think it was a yellow pass. He said, do you have a yellow pass? He said, never heard of one. He said, General, then you can't see that airplane any further than you're looking at it right now. And Jim Davies started to step forward. The kid cocked his rifle. He said, General, one more step and you're dead. Well, he called me up to his headquarters. When he got there, I guess he had time to think about it. He said, would he have shot me? I said, there's no doubt in my mind. He said, I thought so. That's the reason I got back. Now, I said that was enough. I will tell you one thing. They were serious, because the head of my security with my organization was an Italian man by the name of Ioana. I'll never forget Ioana as long as I live. He was a little fellow, but he was a dynamo. He was an electrical engineer, and he was a lawyer. But he was tough. And before he got to my place, we got to talking. Before he got to Wendover, he said, I said, you know, where you been? He said, oh, I said, before I got here, he said, I was in Chicago. I said, what are you doing in Chicago? He said, oh, my partner and I were trying to trace down a leak back there. We knew there was some information being dished out from somebody that was working for Fermi in the Chicago Stadium, and they were supplying the Russians with some information. I said, what'd you do about it? He said, well, we got it all figured out. We saw who was doing it. We got the dope. We cased it. I said, how long did you take? He said, probably 2 weeks before we knew exactly who it was, when information would pass, how it passed. I said, well, how'd it pass? He said, probably the most stupid thing that you ever heard of for an espionage agent. He said, whenever they met under the same street light on a street corner in Chicago, and the information passed hands at that time. I said, what'd y'all do? He said, well, we just got there. We knew the information would be passed that night. He said, we stopped our car there. And he said, we waited for him to appear. I said, okay. How far away were they? He said, oh, 50, 75 yards, something like that. And it was dark. I said, well, what'd y'all do? He said, simple as hell. He said, we took our rifles out and we killed the bastards. Deadly serious. They did. I said, well, you know, what about bodies and whatnot? They said, hell, we got out, we stripped all the identification off. He said, who would in Chicago at that time would pay attention to two bodies laying around on the street? Okay. Now that's how serious they were. I think I've given you enough of some of the spice and some of the things that went on. I would only say that despite the way it sounds, it was deadly serious, and everybody in that thing was dedicated to doing the job that they were supposed to do.